We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Hello there, Bob.
Hello. I hope you're not expecting a Mookie Betts 3-home run leadoff performance.
I am counting on that from you. If there's a man alive who can do that.
I think a stand-up double wouldn't be bad.
But would you swing on a 3-0 count, Bob?
Oh, I sounded off on that one. I've been railing about baseball's so-called unwritten rules for a number of years. And when I read that one in the morning, I went to the Twitter, and I stuck up for Mr. Tatis and the nonsense of it. And, so I see it's really sparked an amazing amount of dialogue. I don't know where that just speaks to. I don't know what it tells you, but it has been a surprising amount of dialogue. But the answer is put me down in the way to go, kid.
Absolutely. And at a time when baseball is struggling to maintain its fan base, man, I think the last thing they should do is be stomping on anything that sparks individuality and excitement and joy.
Well, true. And I didn't even look at it that way. And that's the way people are framing it. That's fine. I certainly will endorse that. But it doesn't even have to mean that. I don't care whether it was 2020 in the midst of a pandemic and baseball, you know, having problems anyway, or whether it was 1968 or 1884, or whether it's 2105 down the road. It's nonsense. I still want to know what the rule is when you can steal a base. I'm very confused about what the cutoff line is about when you can steal a base. So when you hear that one, get back to me. I'll get that straight.
Well, and the other reason, as you pointed out, and others have, I remember a game, and I believe it was 53 years ago tonight when the Red Sox were down, I think, by 10 runs and came back to beat the California Angels 12-11.
Yeah, there's a game. There's a famous game, too. Peter Gammons said he was there, and I don't doubt him at all, in the 60s. When the Red Sox came from something ridiculous down in the ninth inning, 10 or 11 runs, and Jim Pagliaroni capped it off with a grand slam home run, and they came from double digits down. So, most of the runs were two outs. So, these things can happen. That's obviously that can happen. Baseball, it's possible. It's not very often, but it can happen. It's one of the charms of baseball is that it's all about how many outs and not about a clock. We all know that. We can go into that romantic rhetoric anytime we want. But the so it's just silly. The whole thing is just crazy. It's nonsense. As I said, the same thing with stolen bases. But what the hell? By the way, is this kid something else or what? Tatis.
Oh, he's tremendous.
Is he leading the league in homers? He's stolen like six or seven bases, he's the most refreshing breath of fresh air baseball's had. You know, and we've had some good ones in recent years, but this kid is right near the top of the list for instant excitement.
Now, neither one of us can remember the 1932 Red Sox, who were historically bad. But in your time as an observer of the game, are we seeing the worst Red Sox team, at least in the last 5 or 6 decades?
Oh, yeah, I guess 65, they finished ninth, I guess, and they only drew 650,000 people. I don't know how many games they won. There were some dreary teams in the immediate post-Ted era. There were some dreary Red Sox teams. There was certainly no excitement about this team when I first came to Boston in 1964. Everything changed, as we all know, with the turning point in their history, which was 1967. And since then, there's been nothing to equate to this. Even the last place finishes that we've seen in the decade. The teams were not this historically bad. I mean, the winning percentage is frightening, also the margin of error thing is terrifying. I mean, how long is this going to go on? I'm just playing. Wouldn't you like to lose 3-2? That'd be fun.
Well, and how much of this is planned obsolescence? Obviously, they're trying to save some money, but could they have imagined the pitching staff would be this horrible?
I'm hesitant to go there. I'm always hesitant. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I truly don't want to believe they're tanking. I think, you know, go back to when Chaim first came. They thought they were going to have a sale. They certainly expected to have Rodriguez. He traded Price and Betts. And okay, that's, and we knew it was going to be at best a quote-unquote bridge year, which I was okay with. I'm not greedy. I'm very pleased with the way things have gone in the 21st century, and I can tolerate a little step back if the idea is you're going to step back with the hopes of going forward. But, boy, I don't know how long it's going to take. And the pitching thing is going on historically. Mm-hmm. It's even when they've won in all these years, 04, 07, 13, and 18, it was almost exclusively as my mother would say, store-bought pitchers, and not anybody that you developed. Who's the last good pitcher that they developed? I'm trying to think. I guess it would be Buchholz, and yet he ultimately turned out to be I won't say disappointment, but he didn't fulfill the promise that he certainly had. Lester, of course, and what happened with him? They let him go, and so he's the last really good pitcher they developed, John Lester. But he's been out of here quite a while now.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. Now, you mentioned it on social media yesterday. It was 53 years ago last night that Tony Conigliaro hit by that pitch from Jack Hamilton of the Angels. And people who just look at the numbers, I don't think realize not just how good Tony C was, but how important he was to the town and the team, even with Carl Yastrzemski on the other side of the outfield.
Well, I've been up here since 64, as I said, and going through all the four sports. His was phenomenon unlike any others because he was one of ours. Well, I mean, I'm an adopted son now. He was one of ours. He grew up in the North Shore. He went to St. Mary's High School in Lanny, so I'm Swampscott. And I remember reading about him before I ever saw him play in Sports Illustrated. I believe it was Frank DeFord who wrote about him, a story when he was a rookie in 64, and about how he was eating breakfast at home and then driving off to the ballpark after eating his cornflakes. Frank was having fun with the language. My second game in Fenway was Father's Sunday, 1964. I was up here looking at housing before I started my freshman year at BC and with my mother, and we went to Fenway on that Sunday afternoon, and Tony C hit a 3-run homer off Bob DeLiba of the Angels to win the game in the 8th inning. That was the first time I saw him play. But what he meant to this town, absolutely. He was a son of Boston, a complete local kid, and he embraced the city. He did everything. He put a record out of 45. If you can name the two sides of his record, you go to the head of the class.
All right, I remember playing the field, but I'm not sure I remember the flip side.
It's called Little Red Scooter.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, I remember Mamie Van Doren too.
There's never been a phenomenon like it. We haven't had a homegrown basketball player play here of any consequence. We haven't had a homegrown football player play here of any consequence. We've got some good hockey players. We got one right now, Charlie Coyle. Mm. We've had some good ones, but nothing to the magnitude of a Tony C.
Let's shift to the NBA and the Boston Celtics. Can they get this done even without Gordon Hayward?
I doubt it. That was really an edge they had. He was back pretty much where he had been. He was a tremendous facilitator. They were talking about fourth scoring option because we got 3 20-point scorers. He was averaging 17. He was playing well. I don't think so. I didn't think they were going to go all the way anyway, but I certainly expected them to beat Philly and make a run at getting to the finals. But I've lowered the bar completely now for me. I'm back in the, okay, whatever you do, but it's then I was thinking about it this morning. All right, it's year 7 for Brad now, or year 6, end of year 6, I believe. And this group's style got a little bit of a group identity, with Tatum and Brown and Smart. Now even Tice has given us some continuity. And the window's open for them to really do something. And now, you don't want to waste a year. You hate having an opportunity squandered. So it's like if Pasternak doesn't come back to full form, it's going to be a really bitter, bad feeling. Yeah, I think it's a major, a serious problem. Also, one way to rectify it to a degree is Smart to start playing. He was no factor in that first game. He's capable of going out there and scoring as well as all the other stuff he always does.
Who's the best team, the team to beat in this NBA bubble right now?
I think Toronto. Now, I know they're struggling with the Nets today. Is it over yet? No. No, it's not over. But I think they have played with the boulder on their shoulder from day one. There's no more motivated. No, I guess it is over. There's no more motivated. Yeah, 104-99. They did win. They were being pushed by the Nets. How about last night? How about yesterday with the two number ones losing?
Yeah, that was great.
Rich, I have been skeptical. I'm going to get my seize my opportunity here. I've been skeptical about the Bucks. I don't understand. I couldn't get it in my head that they were that good. I didn't quite grasp. I know how good he is. You know who he is.
Right.
But I still didn't grasp that they, as a team, were that good to be 53-12, which they were going into the bubble. But they and I just couldn't get it. And now I watched that entire game last night, and the vulnerabilities were rather evident to me. So I don't think they're going to win. And the Lakers are going to miss those guys. You know, especially Bradley. They were vulnerable. There's an open opportunity for somebody. And I'll tell you, Toronto. It's amazing what they've done without Leonard, but I like them a lot.
Are the Lakers the best team in Los Angeles?
Very good question. And of course, all we neutrals or Eastern neutrals are, that's the series we want to see, naturally. And it's Clippers and the Lakers. And although it will lose some of its charm being in that neutral floor, because one of the funny things would have been if it had been in the Forum, that even the Clipper home games would have had a Laker crowd. I mean, there would have been a Laker presence. You would have felt it in that building, even with their own season ticket base. The Lakers fans have managed to neutralize that in those games. But that's now you got a complete neutral situation. This whole dynamics of the no fans thing is very interesting. It really is. And the fact that you can't draw upon that energy of, teams, the home court advantage is more important, I think, than the road team disadvantage. I think it always has been.
You mentioned Sports Illustrated, Bob, and you tweeted about it yesterday. I don't go back quite as far, but the first episode of the first edition I got was the issue in 1967 when Kari Ostrzemski was named a Sportsman of the Year. Mm-hmm. And for years, SI was the standard, the gold standard, from Frank to Ford to just so many talented writers, and how sad it is to see what they've become.
Well, it's first of all, the world has changed, and there's no appetite for the need for this, what they did, the way it was done then, because of instant availability of information and of literature. You know, I mean, the world was different. Is different. It was a very vital thing. It was to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated was the most coveted thing in all of the team sports or individual sports. There's no question. But I think the run is over. And the reason that I'm not going to renew my subscription is not that when the issues as they are now are horrible, although we've been cut back. It's the nature of the bosses, the new company, or these evil people. And they've gotten rid of everybody I know, and they've gotten rid of people, and there's a lot of unrest I know on the staff, because they're this Maven outfit, or they're bad people. A lot of bad people that own a lot of media entities, as you know, in both broadcast and print, and we all know that. And these are one of them, the Maven people. So they've trashed the morale of Sports Illustrated, and I'm done with it. I won't be renewing.
I don't blame you, but when they started selling supplements, that was the end for me.
Yeah, well, you know, you're right. I grew up. That's well. If you asked me when I was age 20, what do you want to be, Bob? I said I want to be Frank DeFord. I wanted to work for them, and I wanted to be him. And it didn't. And then I learned as time went on, I was lucky I wasn't working there not long before Maven took over, because it was a tough place for certain people to work. It was a editor's magazine rather than a writer's magazine. And I remember Frank, Dan Jenkins once famously said that he should just write his story and then cut off the first five paragraphs because they're going to mess it up anyway. And that's Dan Jenkins, if you can imagine. They had a who's who roster of some of the greatest sports writers in American history. And I wanted to be a part of it, but it turned out, I went on another path and happily, but I feel badly about it. It's such a part of our sport experience. Those days are gone. There's no need. There's no appetite or hunger for publications like that anymore.
And I remember that it was a weekly ritual, not just to get Sports Illustrated, but Sport Magazine and the Sporting News.
Well, I had them all. I got subscription to Sport when I was and Sporting News when I was 9. They gave me for Christmas, I still have 100. I think I counted one day. I got 136 Sport magazines downstairs, and I've got about 150 Sporting News is going back into the 50s. What am I going to do with them? I don't know. You want some?
I have a few of my own.
They're fun. They're fun to pull out and read. But that's how you followed it. You know, the way you followed sports was your morning paper. Your radio coverage because there was very little ongoing TV in any market. Your radio coverage, and then of course you had to have sport, which was one thing, and then you have sporting news 365 weeks, 52 weeks a year, covering baseball, and then they did cover other things. Actually, big thrill I got when I got to write for them was the NBA basketball columnist for a couple of years back,
right,
in the mid 70s. That was a major thrill, and so sport and sporting news, they complemented each other for me. I mean, they were different. That I used to say that sport got to the gut, and Sports Illustrated got to them. To the literature, the mind a little more, but Sport Magazine got to the gut.
No question about it. Bob, always a pleasure for us to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, and wish everybody well.
We'll talk with you soon. Bob Ryan at the Boston Globe here on Downtown.